talk about the challenges section of the report, which we've organized around 7 subsections. I'm only going to be focusing on 5 of them, which you can see up there. The first unique and irreplaceable cultural heritage material. One of the organizing principles of this report is the conviction that the contents of discs, computers, and other digital media in archival repositories and elsewhere is important to preserve. So what kinds of materials are we talking about? What is actually at risk? Some examples are, were talked about yesterday at the document Michael Olson showed us from the Stephen J. Gould papers. Is an example of a type of manuscript that is on legacy media. Some of these manuscripts will have recoverable revision histories. Other authors may have track changes. Correspondence and digital videos and photos and emails are some other examples of the types of things that we can expect to recover. There are also things that there are no paper counterpart for, such as websites, databases, and hypertext literary works. And I'm sure you can all think of many more examples. Within these files and on these media are customized files and personal computing environments of authors, artists, and politicians. So the people who are creating these files also sort of lend their aura to the materials that we have in the repositories. In preserving these materials, we'll be preserving information about people's creative and professional processes, or potentially the workings and production of an organization, if organizational files are what your repository gets. And finally, personal digital archives are not only being created by famous people. That's not the only thing we're getting into in repositories. As most of you know, with our paper collections, there's a lot of documentation from just ordinary people, people who send correspondence to famous authors. In the case of personal digital archives, it becomes much easier to maintain your own digital archive. So part of what we're going to be preserving is things that were created by ordinary people that document life in the 20th century and beyond. These materials will be a combination of the simple, for example, text files, and also the complex. Websites and databases are an example of that. But regardless, even the most simple digital documents, and not to mention complex environments like computers, or somebody's entire hard drive, have the potential to exhibit extraordinarily and often tailored complexity. That can serve as a window into how the documents in a particular collection were formed and perhaps even why. So preserving born digital materials means not only preserving the object itself, but also its relationship to other objects. These relationships are part of what make the individual files unique. So those relationships, how a file fits into a particular system, whether that system is actually a file system or someone's personal organizational strategy, or a much larger network, are part of what makes each file unique and irreplaceable. These relationships between files in a shared environment are also highly at risk of being lost, as are the connections across media types within a hybrid collection. Most of our collections at this point are hybrid. This is an access challenge as well as a preservation challenge. So the question becomes not only what are the best ways to preserve and discern these relationships, but also, once we've captured the information, how do we represent it to researchers and other users? As I said before, at least in this community, the idea that born digital materials are unique, irreplaceable, and of great importance and usefulness is a given. But so far, we have some concrete examples of how and why, and we can conjecture about others. But I think the reality is that many archivists and curators don't know enough at this point to accurately characterize the content of our born digital collections and actually articulate what is unique and what's preserving about them, and describe to researchers, donors, and our administrations how they can be used and why additional support is necessary to preserve these materials. Some do, but many more do not, I think. And all this means is that more analysis is needed, and by all parties. It's also too important to include creators as part of this equation. Interviews with creators and a methodology that borrows from ethnography or perhaps oral history are needed to supplement forensic techniques of capture and analysis to buttress arguments about what materials we have and why they're important. The next section I'm going to talk about is legacy formats. And in our report, this section focuses on historical or legacy media and the challenges it poses for digital preservation, as well as the ways in which incorporating forensic techniques into the archival workflow can help make the capture and identification of legacy formats more efficient and also more feasible. Computer and external data storage devices obsolesce on several levels. The report touches on file system, operating system, / application level, and also hardware. Files created in one file system often differ substantially from those created in another. An easy example is the types of characters that are allowed in directory and file names often differ between systems. So a file name with a / in it, for example, that was created in one system might not be transferable to a different file system that doesn't allow that particular character. To a certain degree, disk images may serve as a barrier between the file system of the storage environment in which the image is saved and the individual files within the image. For example, the idiosyncrasies of personal naming conventions for individual files, which are important to preserve, won't be as big of a deal if those files are contained within an image, because the file system will interact with the image file rather than its contents. And that image file will ideally be named according to the repository's naming conventions and not include potentially problematic characters. However, as individual directories and files are carved from disk images for processing, the impact of file system specifications on naming and organizational practices will likely resurface and influence the methods archivists use to discern and preserve them and also store these files. One of the main challenges with regard to legacy software, which includes operating systems, is how to identify the application used to create a particular file and then use that information to formulate preservation and access strategies that balance what an archivist or curator has time for with what a researcher needs in order to use the materials. Some examples of access strategies include delivery of an original copy or migrated access copy via an online repository, and the use of emulation to provide access to files in a simulation of their original environment. Software is often operating system specific, so a version of a program designed for an older operating system may not run its contemporary counterpart. Metadata harvesters and batch ingest tools, batch identification tools, once I've used these days, I can't stop thinking about batch ingest. Registries to identify file formats and open source and proprietary forensic software can help automate the analysis of more digital materials. These tools can extract and analyze a wide variety of metadata that archivists and curators can use to make informed decisions about how best to preserve files for the long term, and also to judge what time frame might be realistic for providing patrons with access to these files. In terms of hardware, born digital acquisitions may include hard drives as well as external data storage devices, as you all know, such as disk cartridges, CDs, memory cards, flash drives, anything else you can think of. The majority of what many archives have received to date is older media rather than cutting-edge technology, or perhaps computers and other types of storage that were cutting-edge at the time but are now very outdated. Although forensic workstations can be customized to include some types of older drives, by and large, forensic tools are more geared towards contemporary machines. It will be important to continue to build on the work that Jeremy John and others have done to identify forensic tools that can help us preserve files on outdated hardware. And perhaps in the future, archivists will even have a hand in creating them. For these reasons, collecting older machines and components may enable archivists to devise strategies for capturing images of older media in the event that the methods and technology developed for use with more contemporary machines are not adequate. The challenges presented by legacy formats are ongoing and will change as technology continues to develop. So determining what archivists and scholars need to know about legacy formats in order to preserve and use foreign digital materials is an open question. More work will need to be done by both parties in order to determine how best to proceed, and factors such as funding, staff, equipment, and institutional support will play a large part in determining whether and how archivists, curators, and others proceed. The third section I'm going to talk about is trustworthiness. In the report, this section addresses the broad issues related to trust with regard to foreign digital materials, and in particular, the role forensics can play in defining and establishing this trust. We consider the role of trust as a digital object makes its journey from the creator through intermediaries such as both human and technological to the archival repository where the physical object will be housed, and then finally into preservation storage and eventually also into a digital repository or management system. In order for digital materials to travel safely from creator to archival repository and to be documented properly, creators, dealers, and archivists and curators will need to work together to assume some level of responsibility for the trustworthiness of the digital files. As digital items comprise more and more the bulk of archival collections, dealers in particular will need to find non-invasive ways to assess the contents of digital media for representation and collection inventories and the like. In addition, once a creator or dealer has found a home for a born digital collection, it would be ideal for the materials to reach their final destination with the documented chain of custody and authentication information that can be verified upon arrival. Repositories are the third agent discussed in this section. And the point I'd like to highlight from that discussion is that an institution that has a good reputation and proven track record for conserving, processing, and making available paper materials, in other words, is trusted to handle traditional archival materials, is not necessarily a trustworthy custodian of digital objects. This means that archival repositories must re-earn, in some cases, the trust of current and future digital creators. Developing a robust infrastructure and long-term preservation plan are necessary steps toward building that trust and demonstrating that an archival repository and its staff are trustworthy stewards of the foreign digital materials in their care. Forensic methods of capture, authentication, and documentation can ensure that information acquired from a foreign digital object in such a way that it can be proven not to alter the original bitstream. The checksums generated in conjunction with the capture process can be prepared by creators and intermediaries and repositories at different stages of the transfer process to verify that disk images and other files are exact copies of the original bitstreams and that their integrity is remained intact. Forensic tools can also be used to recover, delete, or hidden files, as we heard yesterday, as well as conduct text and image searches in order to discover particular content or types of files. These analytic capabilities raise serious ethical questions, particularly with regard to how archivists and curators work with data creators. And Richard will address some of these concerns in this part of the presentation. On the other hand, these same analytic capabilities can also give archivists and curators a means by which to build trust with the creator. For example, forensic tools give an archivist the ability to show a creator the different types of data in her born digital archives and come to an agreement prior to formal acquisition about what she does and does not want to transfer to the repository. Ideally, these tools will not only help archivists establish the trustworthiness of the materials, but will also help repositories build informed relationships with the creators whose digital materials are in their care. One of the key challenges facing the archivist or scholar when dealing with digital forensics at any level of complexity is how to determine and then repeatedly prove the authenticity of an object in their care. The tools we've heard discussed over the last day can be used to provide proof of a file's integrity, but equally important are organizational techniques that revolve around systems of human behavior, such as encouraging professional ethics, recruiting staff with the appropriate skills and attitudes, and implementing quality assurance strategies. One way of approaching the issue of data integrity is to examine documents at two levels. Prior to accession, a process which may include ingest into a formal archive, and then after ingest. The transfer process for digital materials needs to be managed carefully and with rigorous adherence to documented procedures. These involve standard elements of archival accessioning, which have been adapted to the needs of digital information. Transferring archives in a managed way will minimize the risk of interference with the material and will allow the archivist to be sure that what is accessioned into an archival collection can then be monitored and kept intact. Ensuring the integrity of data after accessioning requires careful adherence to good archival practice, as well as the rigorous application of technical procedures to ensure that the digital records are not interfered with and altered once they've been accessioned into an archive. Two of the most important and widely used metadata schemes for digital libraries, Premise and Metz, include provision for recording fixing information, including hash functions, checksums, cryptographic hash functions, and digital signatures. Provenance or chain of custody is another piece of contextual information that is important in establishing the authenticity of a digital object. In the digital world, provenance prior to acquisition can be harder to establish, but strategies such as personal visits and interviews with the creator can help document the circumstances in which the digital files were acquired and also help judge the context and environment in which the data originally resided. The last section I'm going to talk about is costing. The cost of providing an infrastructure for a forensic approach to digital preservation has not been fully determined. The CDRS Project, the Digital Preservation Coalition, the British Library, National Archives, and LIFE, the Lifecycle Information for E-Literature Project, have all made contributions to our understanding of this aspect of digital preservation. A couple of the panelists yesterday offered estimates of the cost for their repositories to acquire forensic equipment and software, and Susan Thomas made the important point that the cost of training to use forensic hardware and software is another expenditure that needs to be considered. Another panelist, I'm sorry for not remembering exactly who, suggested that remote acquisition of foreign digital collections, as opposed to traveling to visit a creator in person, might become an important cost-saving strategy in the future. Certain parts of the forensic process, like creating a disk image, are things that you don't need special software to do, although you do need a drive or connector that can be used to access your media from a workstation. Open source tools can perform many of the same functions as the software packages offered by companies like Encase and Access Data. But then the question becomes one of staff time. Does the cost of the staff time necessary to install, learn, and customize the different components of an open source tool like the Sleuthkit exceed the cost of commercial software that also requires training yet may be packaged in a way that ultimately requires less staff time to implement? This is a theoretical question for me with practical implications because I haven't downloaded any of the open source tools or had the opportunity to play with FTK or Encase or any of those things. An important part of assessing costs will be figuring out which elements of a particular approach, such as forensics, are necessary and support archival concepts. Which elements introduce techniques and ideas that are new to archival practice, but make sense and complement or even improve upon methods already in place, and then also which components of a forensic approach may be interesting but not strictly necessary until an archivist or curator reaches a certain phase of the long-term preservation process. The level of technical and organizational commitment required in order to develop capacity and competence in the area of digital forensics is likely to be highly significant for the foreseeable future. Even if a repository chooses to use open source tools, funds are still necessary to purchase hardware for workstation and storage, pay staff salaries, and develop interfaces and potentially also tools for researchers. The number of institutions capable of delivering the level of technical competence and organizational capacity over a sustained period is likely to be small, and the financial resources that these institutions will need is likely to be greater than the requirements for most institutions that have a commitment to maintain the basic infrastructure for digital preservation and access.